Honey, the power's out.
Flashlight's dead. Can't find batteries.
Hey, neighbors. Want to borrow my Star Patrol spotlight?
That flashlight lights up the whole house.
Watch. The Star Patrol can light up the whole neighborhood. It can illuminate up to a half mile away.
A half mile? That's insanely bright.
And the Turbo Boost increases brightness up to 100%.
Whoa, now that's insanely bright.
With 10 illumination modes, the Star Patrol is a flashlight, spotlight, floodlight, emergency light, and more. And with an ultra-fast USB power bank, you can even charge your phone with it. Plus, the Star Patrol is fully rechargeable and backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee.
So how do I get one of these Star Patrols?
Go to GetStarPatrol.com and you'll get it with free Turbo Boost, free shipping, and a money-back guarantee. Again, that's GetStarPatrol.com. GetStarPatrol.com.
Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. Welcome, welcome, welcome to Smarter News, to the Inside Scoop, as we kick off the first scoop for November. So is anything happening this week? Anything exciting going on that we need to cover? I mean, I feel like, can you take two steps without hearing about the election of 2024? I can't. And at this point, I'm a little bit frustrated. So this is going to be like, you know, the many cycles of grief, for example. You know, you go through all these different iterations. I feel like we're in that sort of cycle for the news, because it goes from like anger to disappointment to dejection to all these different feelings based on, you know, just the sheer amount of press coverage. Hyperbole is strong. A lot of terms being used to describe this election, I feel like, in the effort to get people connected or watching, is a little bit over the top. Have you noticed that? You know, it's like, there's never been an election like this ever. It's historic. All of these, listen, every election in America is historic for its own reasons. Some are more exciting or less exciting than others. But I have to just take a step back. You know, when we think about the election process in America, do we really think like this is the most consequential election, I'm sorry, don't mean to laugh, in American history, like compared to the few elections after the American Revolution, during the War of 1812, where the British actually came in and like burned part of the White House. And there was a big question about whether or not the country would exist, or the Civil War, or what about during World War I or World War II? I mean, we've gone through quite a bit as a country. I think it's just worth reminding ourselves of that. I'm not suggesting that this is not consequential and that our decisions don't matter. They certainly do. And it's not just the top of the ticket. It's not just about the president who we're going to elect. It's also down ballot. By the way, that sort of expression is interesting, because you really have to picture the ballot, because at the top, usually it's where you pick your president, and then you'll go down and see, you know, senator, House of Representative, governor. It depends on your state. Every ballot's going to look a little different, but that's what we're talking about when we say down ballot or down ticket. And usually it has been true in the past that your top of the ticket vote will establish how you're going to vote down ticket. But I have a little bit of a curveball to share with you on that based on some of your results. So anyhow, I just think, yes, every election is historic. If we could just turn down the volume a little bit as members of the media, it probably would be helpful so that we can all kind of participate in this process and not feel like we're going to pull our hair out, because I don't know, maybe it's just me. Can feel that way a little bit. It's like, so let's just take a breath. Okay. Now, what we're going to do today is we're going to go over some of your questions. Some of them are all of your questions are excellent. And what I was going to say is that some of them really reflect the major themes that all the media should be covering right now. These are really important questions for how this process plays out. And although we all hopefully, you know, had a little bit of civics education in high school, we all have to review this every few years about what does this process actually look like? Why do we even have the Electoral College? How does that even work? What about when voting ends? What about when we're counting ballots? what about election fraud and integrity and all these sorts of questions? So you really covered a lot of the big hot topics, and that's what we're going to use today. This is going to be the first scoop in a long time where I'm not using outside voices. I'm using your voices. Your voices are the most important. So that's what we're really going to structure scoop about, which is really looking at your questions and getting you answers and being a source of support during this time. And that's what I hope to be over the next several days. Before we get started, I do want to mention a couple, just one brief news item that I thought was really interesting and important to flag for you. As is true with many elections, the age-old phrase that will keep coming back is, it's all about the economy. It's all about the economy. And that may or may not be true in this particular election. We'll see what the results are and what voters said really moved them. But I did want to flag for you the jobs report that came out on Friday. It was a very unique report because it showed only 12,000 jobs created in the month of October. And that's a very low number, no matter which way you slice it. The expectation was not for huge job creation, but it was in the six figures, 100,000. So seeing 12,000 jobs created was a big, big difference. However, this is not your typical report because we had two hurricanes. We have a massive Boeing strike that's still ongoing. There seems to be some movement on that. So there's a lot of factors in this jobs report that give the media an excuse not to cover it, or at least say, okay, well, here's what this is, but it's not, this is not what it's going to be in the next several months, because it's very unusual that we see this sort of job creation. And that is true. I want you to know that it is very unusual to see this low job creation. And it is very true that the hurricanes, as well as this strike, have impacted not only jobs being created, but also the way data is collected. And so we could see then going into the next few months, pent up job demand, or the data starts evening out. And it may take 2 or 3 months to do that. So that's important to note. The bigger picture is that when we look at the previous months, the number of jobs created was also revised downward. So this trend of slower job growth is real. It's happening. It's also part of the Federal Reserve's plan. Now, the Federal Reserve is not directly about the labor market, but is determining borrowing rates and trying to bring down inflation. There was a desire to also kind of slow everything down, tap on the brakes a little bit, which included seeing lower job creation because we don't want the economy overheating. There's too much inflation, there's too much demand, and the prices are getting out of control. So seeing slower jobs created as a matter of a part of this broader policy and lower inflation is a variable. But I want you to know that this is taking place, and I feel like it's sort of being buried a little bit in all this effort to cover politics. And although that's the big story of the moment, and we're going to cover it too, I just wanted to flag that for you. I also wanted to share this. Oftentimes we talk about the election impacting the way people are behaving, how we're shopping, whether or not we're buying homes, how companies are making decisions. And this was such an interesting fact from CNBC. It's a look at how many times the word election came up in earnings calls. So earnings calls are these reports that are coming out really every 90 days by publicly traded companies. And what we're looking for here is the election just even mentioned as a factor for either company performance or looking forward into the future. And so here's what I want to read for you. The word election came up on 100 earning calls of S&P 500 listed firms between September 15th and October 31st, according to FactSet. That's the highest number of companies in the broad index mentioning the word during that time frame, according to CNBC's screens of the same period going back to 2004. So going back 20 years. This is the most that we've seen that term mentioned. And so it's just a reminder that there's a lot of waiting and seeing and wondering what's next. And we may feel that in our own personal and family lives, but we're seeing it on a broader level for some of these really big companies too, trying to plan. And right now, it can be difficult to plan if you're looking to see, well, who's going to lead the country? Not only who's going to be president, but what about Congress? You know, what about the House of Representatives? Everybody's up for re-election there, and a third of the Senate. So if you're really trying to plan and you're thinking about what to do, is now the time that you're going to make some of those bigger decisions? Probably not. And this is true of most election cycles, but even just that little data point from CNBC, it's the election's being mentioned even more by these major companies. So I thought that was interesting and a little bit maybe perhaps validating for all of us that it's everybody's thinking about this and getting to the other side, getting to the other side. And that's the big question of like, well, when do you get to the other side? When are we actually going to get results? We're going to talk a little bit about that. So first of all, one of the things I did over the weekend is I did a unscientific survey of Smarter News followers, of the Smarter News community. I was very curious about how you're feeling about the election. Let me pull something up for you. I want to show this to you. One of the things that we do is we like to share Real Clear Politics, the polling average, because the polling average is going to give us an idea when we take all the different polls together and we mix them up. What do we get out of that? And that's a way that Real Clear Politics was trying to take out some of the bias of some of these polls. Okay, you know, an oversampling of Republicans, oversampling of Democrats, urban, rural, young, old, women, men. What is this going to look like? And so the Real Clear Politics average, you can see in this box, it's hard to see on your screen here. I've actually never seen it this way before. The Real Clear Politics national average of polling has a dead tie as of this moment, 12:20 Central Time, the day before the election. 48.5 for Trump, 48.5 for Harris. I've never seen that before. Think about what it takes to make that happen. All the different polls that are involved for it to actually, you shake it up and what comes out is a tie. What happens if there's a tie? I actually asked Tom Bevin, he's the founder of Real Clear Politics, about this. Here's what he had to say.
A few weeks ago, I saw some different headlines that were suggesting that we could see an electoral tie.
Ah, yes.
Is that possible?
The elusive tie. Well, yeah. I mean, we talk about it because it would be crazy, right? It would be a huge story. I think it's a very, very low probability, but you can certainly play with a map and come up with scenarios where it's a 269-269 tie. And obviously, if you want to see heads explode, around the country to Matt.
I don't know if I want to see it, Tom.
To the House of Representatives, where the delegations from each state would vote to select the president of the United States. And right now, that would mean Donald Trump would win because Republicans have a majority in those states.
It's right. And so that's important. It's those that are sitting in Congress now that would determine that, not anybody new that would be coming in. Right. So you could, okay, that's good. Just to prepare, I don't want anything exploding.
It's a low probability event. But again, I mean, you can't rule anything out at this point. I mean, I always tell people my theory of the case is that, you know, it's Murphy's Law plus, you know, Occam's Razor plus the chaos theory. Whatever the craziest thing you can imagine, it's probably going to happen. And it might even be worse than that. I mean, just imagine the things that we've seen over the last few weeks with Biden dropping out, assassination attempts. I mean, it's been like four campaigns in one just in the last 3 months.
Four campaigns in one in the last 3 months. See, you guys, this is why we're so tired. We've had to go through all of it. Julie, I love what you said here. Julie says a tie feels on brand for this election. Yes, it does, Julie. And look at that. It's a possibility. We've never seen that before. But would that surprise any of us? Like, how many times have we said unprecedented in the last several years? I mean, we're just on that ride, guys. This is where we are. So we'll see if it actually pans out that way. If it does, and yes, it is a very small possibility that it does. But if it does, it would go to the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives right now is currently majority Republican. And those people that could be making that decision, that would be making that decision, some of them would not be in the next Congress. They would have been potentially voted out already. And yet they're making the decision for the next leader of the free world. So these are the stakes. This is what's going on. And it's this idea, maybe this is a way that we can all take a breath, that someone somewhere knows something that someone else doesn't and it can predict what's going to happen in the future. That's not the case. We're going to have to really wait and see what voters actually do. And I got a great reminder of that this weekend. So this weekend, I surveyed our Smarter News community and I asked, who are you voting for? It is very seldom in the course of my career that I have asked someone such a personal question so directly. But I was genuinely curious. And with all of this different polling data and these voices yelling on the news, I genuinely wanted to know, how are you feeling? What does it look like to you? Who are you favoring? And this is very unscientific. It's an unscientific poll, but it's a great survey that's helped direct our reporting. So here are three surprising things I learned from you this weekend based on your answer to the question, who are you voting for and why? The first thing I learned, the group of double haters that we talked about a few months ago are real and still very active, meaning that there's a group of voters who don't like either candidate. And they are not voting for either candidate. Some of them are not voting for any of them and are instead writing in a candidate or deciding not to vote at the top of the ticket and cast their ballot for other offices, but refusing because they don't feel compelled to vote for either candidate. There are some double haters that responded that said that they were still undecided. And this is just a day or two before the election. So the feeling of being disillusioned with both choices is real. In that same category of double haters, I want to flag this subset of voters that I saw for the very first time, surprising in the number of folks that wound up in this category. These are not double haters, but these are those that are switching from their party affiliation. There were a number of Democrats saying that for the very first time in their life, they were going to vote Republican. And similarly, there was a group of Republicans who said they've never voted Democrat that said for the very first time, they're going to cast their ballot for the Democrat at the top of the ticket. So this is important because in this media environment where we're trying to stereotype and cast people, you know, the female voter, the Hispanic voter, the Republican voter, the suburban voter, that's not going to apply across the board this time. There were way too many people in their responses that were saying they felt not aligned with how they maybe would have described themselves. That was very fascinating and I think really important for this election. So that takes away the predictive ability that the press and pollsters want to have. These are surprising voters. They're unique, they're individual, and they're active. They're active. I didn't get a lot of double haters or undecideds who were like, I don't think I'm going to vote. Now, maybe they just didn't respond to the polls, but it seemed that there was still a desire to vote. But for those that felt conflicted, they weren't in a rush to vote for somebody. If they didn't feel compelled, they weren't going to vote for that person and they would vote for what other candidates or different issues that they felt that they wanted to weigh in on. The second thing that I learned from our voters on Smarter News was many of the folks who were casting a ballot for former President Trump were doing so not because of him or not just because of him, but because of the team that he fielded. There were many references to the team that he has built around him, including Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and others. And there were voters who said, I am not a huge supporter of former President Trump, but I like the direction of this team. And I want to give them an opportunity. So for some, the vote was definitely for former President Trump. They were all in, felt supportive of him, but there was definitely a wide swath of Trump voters who said, we like the team. We like the team. We're not just about the one candidate. The third thing I learned, those that were voting for Vice President Harris were voting just as much for her policies as they were a vote against former President Trump. So one of the voters who wrote in said, when I asked, you know, why are you voting for Vice President Harris? The response was for her dignity, for her plans for the future, mostly because she's not former President Trump. That's a very interesting observation. So there is a momentum against former President Trump. And it's less of a vote for, although that's part of it, as much as a vote against the other candidate. And I'm curious if that's true for former President Trump as well. Is the vote for former President Trump as much of an angry vote against Vice President Harris Or is it about other things? It feels a little bit different. And I'm curious about how all these votes pan out. But the big takeaway, these labels that we're trying to use to describe different voters just don't apply anymore. There's all these different switcheroos that are taking place. That's a technical term. Switcheroos in this election. Former Republicans, well, actually, I wouldn't even say former Republicans, current Republicans voting Democrat, current Democrats voting Republican, have their different reasons as to why, and still a large group of double haters that still feel undecided. So we'll see if they make up their mind and cast their ballot. I'm curious if you identify with any of those things that you heard. Are you feeling that way? Do you feel that the way that the news is talking about you or your voting subset doesn't actually cover the nuance of that group and perhaps is giving a different picture of the U.S. electoral process or of the broader audience than it really is? You know, here we are. We're all individuals and we don't have to vote in one way or the other. So this is very interesting to me. It makes me wonder, you know, what we could actually see, if anything that we're anticipating is true. Tom Bevin again said, garbage in, garbage out. If there's garbage in for some of these polling and poll results, then we have no idea what's going to happen. And maybe the tie isn't even possible. Let's talk a little bit about paths to victory, and then I'm going to get to your questions. When we talk about paths to victory, what do we even mean? This is the question that I asked Tom Bevin.
Do you see as the necessary parts of the paths to victory for the Democrats and the Republicans? Are they the same or are they party specific?
Well, I mean, when we talk about paths to victory, we're usually talking about the Electoral College. And when you look at the map, as I mentioned, there are only seven states that are really in play. Just in the last 10 days, Trump's got a little bit of separation from her in Georgia. Same thing in Arizona. He's up almost 2 points in our average. And so the Sun Belt is looking like it's not a very fruitful path for Kamala Harris, which is why she's touring the upper Midwest. I mean, if she wins Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, she wins the election, 270 to 268. It would be that close. If Kamala Harris is able to win North Carolina, it's 16 electoral votes. So it gives her some wiggle room to lose Michigan or Wisconsin. Why everybody's focused on Pennsylvania is because it's 19 electoral votes. So if you lose Pennsylvania, you can't just replace it with another state. You have to win two states. And that brings me to the last state, which is Nevada, which is a state that Democrats have traditionally done very well. But this time around, it seems like it's much more competitive. And because of Latino men in particular that have moved towards Trump, that state is very, very close. And so I think Harris, as a backup, she's fighting for that one as well. But those are the paths to victory. For her, it's pretty much the upper Midwest now, unless she's able to win North Carolina. And Trump has multiple paths. I mean, with the Sun Belt, if he can win those states, he's definitely got the advantage.
So interesting. That's what we're talking about, paths to victory in every single state really counting, because it's about the math that adds up to 270. How do we get to 270? Well, it's the majority when we look at the total electoral votes of 538. How do we even get there? What is this even process about? We're going to dig into that. But you can see that it's a little bit like a game of hopscotch, you know, who's able to hop between these different states and get to that 270. And there are ways that you could actually get to a tie as well, although very unusual. So Pennsylvania is why the candidates are there today. We're speaking on Monday. The candidates are all over Pennsylvania today. Former President Trump's going to fly back to Michigan as well later today, probably going into early tomorrow, into Tuesday morning, because that's an important state as well. But Pennsylvania has so many electoral votes. For a small state, it has a lot. Small state geographically, the population is big. And so that's why there's no way to replace that. You can't say, well, I'm going to trade. You get Pennsylvania, then I'm going to get Arizona. There's not an equal trade for electoral votes. And it really is a determinant to get that extra 19, that extra 19 of electoral votes. Let's get into this process a little bit. I want to answer some of your questions, and you asked some great questions about the process overall. So I'm going to kind of go through this in a little bit of an order to get us through the beginning to the end of this voting process. And I'm going to start off with a question from Tanya.
I have a comment and then a question, and I thought I would leave it in a voice memo. It just seems to be a little easier than typing it out in an email. My comment is, I am refreshed that the Washington Post didn't endorse a candidate. I will be very curious to see as to whether they do start becoming a little bit more independent with what they report and not so left-leaning. I would love it if the wind of change happened and we had more news outlets that were like you and gave us just the facts and gave us both sides of the story and let us make up our own mind. So that's just my two cents on the Washington Post endorsement. I don't usually pay attention to celebrities or newspapers when they endorse candidates. And I feel like it's refreshing to see that maybe there is a little bit of a change happening with the press. My question, I am a Texas girl. I usually early vote when I vote, and I have been very curious this year as to whether what I'm seeing in my neck of the woods is happening nationwide. Where I live, our population has grown, and so maybe it's just me and, you know, what I'm seeing here, and we need to open more polling places, but it has been packed almost every day the polls have been open for early voting. I ended up waiting an hour and a half, and that was me coming back several days in a row thinking maybe it was just the, you know, first few days of early voting and then the next day wouldn't be so busy. It was so packed and there were that many people voting. I love it, and I hope that we have just that much more as far as the participation in this wonderful country where we have freedom to vote. I'm just curious, is this happening nationwide? Is this something that people are seeing at other polling places, or, you know, like I said, is it just because my population in my area has grown and we just, you know, have more people and need more polling places open? But I am in the Houston area and I did go to multiple early voting polling places where I could. And it was just amazing to me how many people were waiting in line. And then I ended up waiting an hour and a half, even a week into the early voting. So I'm curious, is this happening nationwide? Is this something that we're seeing all over the place? If you have reporting on that, I would love to know.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Tanya. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but I wanted to show this to you. I was excited to show it to you. This is what we're seeing for tracking early voter turnout. We've been talking, you might have heard, well, you know, early voting is high so far. And we are seeing early voting active. We're not seeing the same sort of early voting necessarily that we're seeing in 2020. And it's important to distinguish between the two. When we talk about early voting, there's early voting in person, then there's early voting in mail-in ballots. And it was the early voting with mail-in ballots. And it's hard for us to sort of like rewind to 2020. I mean, right? It's hard to go back there for several reasons, isn't it? It was a tough time. But part of it was all those concerns about how people were waiting in line, whether or not they felt comfortable to vote in person, what that was going to look like state to state because of different rules. And so there was a lot of folks that were doing mail-in ballots. The sheer number of mail-in ballots was one of the issues in processing. And let me talk about that processing for a second. When you're talking about processing votes, it doesn't necessarily mean counting them. And depending on your state, you are able to process before Election Day or when Election Day starts or when the polls close. And that can mean things like opening up the envelope, putting it flat on a table, putting it into piles, not necessarily counting the votes, although that could happen. It's all of that extra labor that's attached to it. So what we're seeing, at least what I'm showing you here, ironically, from the Washington Post, and I appreciated your thoughts about the endorsements as well. This is early vote so far. As of yesterday, so Sunday at 8 o'clock, we're seeing the number of votes cast by mail and in person before Election Day behind the pace of what it was in 2020. That's not necessarily surprising, but it still shows that it's higher than 2022. So overall, we're seeing active early voting generally across the country. It's not quite as active as it was in 2020, but that actually makes sense. So one of the things that I think is important here to point out is there's a lot of comparisons when we're looking at different elections, and obviously it would make sense to. We have a candidate, former President Trump, that was in an election in 2016, then in 2020, and is now again in 2024. So it's natural to go, what did we do in 2020? What did we do in 2016? There seems to be some sort of a consensus that's happening amongst pollsters and analysts, political analysts, that there's hesitancy in comparing what we're seeing in 2024 to 2020 because it was so unique, because there were a lot of different variables at play, even for how people voted, and that the system itself wasn't ready for all the mail-in ballots that it received, and even the anticipation of that. And so all these new processes had to be put in place. There have been some new rules passed or laws passed in places like Michigan, where now you can start processing these votes earlier to avoid that big surge that we saw overnight, where you went to bed thinking that there was one front runner and then woke up the next day and saw that there was another. And that has to do with the processing time that it takes to look through some of these mail-in ballots or the early voting. And by the way, depending on your state, different votes can be prioritized. You know, are we going to start the voting process with the mail-in ballots early? And then what about the people that are voting in person? How are things put together? It all depends on your state. It all depends. And the experience of how active voters are, lines and all of that really are going to be state specific. But overall, that graph shows us that there's been a lot of active early voting. So I'm curious what it looks like on election day if we get even more of a surge of voters that shows that participation is high, which, by the way, it would be great in America that we have a lot of people participating in the process. We want to see more people represented, not fewer. And so I hope that answers some of your questions. Okay, let's go ahead and go to Kate, who has a question about the process overall.
Hi, Jenna. Kate here from just south of Nashville, Tennessee. My question regarding the election is about how the votes in each county add up to become the total electoral vote for the state, meaning I know Tennessee is typically a quote-unquote red state, but some of the counties with bigger cities tend to lean left. And how do they, I guess, tally up the votes from each county to then say, okay, these, I think we have 11 electoral votes go towards President Trump or Vice President Harris? Is it number of votes in the county, or is it... I just don't know how that whole process works. All right. Thanks for all you do. I love Scoop, especially this time of year. You are a lifesaver in the craziness that is the news. Thanks.
Thank you, Kate. I appreciate that. I feel the same way about you guys. I don't know how I would exist in this media environment without you. So I really appreciate it. And Kate, you really brought me back to thinking about how the electoral process is actually done. And I think we could just use a little bit of an overview of that, if you guys don't mind indulging me. And some of you may be better at civics than I am. So please feel free to just jump on the live chat if you have additional questions or clarifications, because I want to make sure this is clear. In fact, what I'm going to do is pull this up so you can see it a little bit better. So let's just talk about the electoral process in general. You know, why do we even have it? It's said over and over again, well, we don't want just a popularity vote in America. Why do we not want that? Well, even at the beginning of the country, there was a feeling of a concern of tyranny of the majority. You know, if someone gets in power, they can stay in power for a long time. And if the voting is weighed in certain directions, you know, for example, around major population areas, perhaps that allows the majority to just stay in power. That looks more like a monarchy. That doesn't look like America. And so we're going to try to develop a system that is going to give weight where there needs to be weight. If there's more Americans in a certain area, they do get more of a say, but we don't want the smaller states just to be completely left out. So how do we do this? So the Electoral College came about looking at how do you give equal representation to all states. So every state has two senators. Every state has two electoral votes that go along with those senators. But then the rewarding of additional electoral votes has to do with the population in that state and how many representatives that state has to Congress. So places like California, Florida, Texas, these are really big states. They have more electoral votes. They also have more representatives in Congress. This is the way that the system is trying to kind of figure out, okay, well, there's more people there, so we want them represented, but we don't want them overly represented. So they tilt the entire system into one direction. This was the attempt to do that. So when we're talking about the electoral votes, there is a difference on a state level. So broadly speaking, it's not a popularity contest. Those that get the popular vote don't necessarily win president. It depends on who is winning the certain combination of states that we talked about to get to that 270. But within your state, it is a popularity contest, in that the states will award their electoral votes to whoever wins in that state. There are only two states, Nebraska and Maine, that are going to split their electoral votes depending on results if that takes place. But in general, if the majority of voters in the state of Texas say they want former President Trump, that's anticipated, by the way, although Texas is looking more and more like it could potentially be a swing state in the future, then former President Trump, if he wins that state, will get all those votes. Similarly, Vice President Harris is likely to win in California. She's going to get all those electoral votes. And so as the counties are reporting, they're starting to report their results as the day goes on election day. Sometimes they're reporting in the hours that follow. And quite frankly, there is some efficiency to the system in that in many places, we could actually get results for that county. It can be turned over to the state. And then there's a whole process for the state to certify those results. It's really important to point out on election night, when we're talking about the races being called, these are media calls. These are not official calls for the race. So the media is stepping forward and saying, based on the information that we have, the reports that are being done, the number of counties reporting, the decision desk for whatever news organization is saying, we know that there's only 1,000 extra votes out there potentially. So we can say with confidence that the results that we're seeing are suggesting that we're going to call the state for Vice President Harris, or we're going to call the state for former President Trump. Can media organizations be wrong? They can. The Associated Press has a good track record, but you have to be careful because you can call something too soon. And it'll take several weeks for the states themselves to certify their results and say, these are actually the results from the state. So when we have been talking about a president being announced, let's go back to 2016, when in the middle of the night, there was a question about going into the night, what would the results look like? And at that time, former President Trump's path to victory was more difficult than the one he has now. And that has a lot to do with the state of Florida, by the way, because Florida is such a big state. And for Democrats in the past, there was a question, can they actually win Florida? In the last several elections, that hasn't been the case. So, but looking back on 2016, it was the middle of the night. Many people had gone to bed. Some had not. I was up. And suddenly the race is called for former President Trump. That's a media call. That wasn't an official result, although former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton came out and conceded. So it's not official. It feels official, but it's not really official. And that's where it gets a little tough. So I hope that's helpful. Inside your state, it is a popularity contest. And that's how the electoral votes get awarded in a process that's supposed to be not a popularity contest. And that's where it can get a little bit confusing. So as different counties are reporting, whether it's, you know, local results that we're starting to see, every media organization has their own decision desk. And they're looking into their own research and how they're looking at these results from these different states, and they're making a call. And that's how we're getting to it. So, Kate, I hope that's helpful. It's definitely confusing. It's not a process that is natural, the Electoral College. And obviously it's not one that we use on a regular basis. We just use it every 4 years. So if you have more questions on that, happy to help as we move forward. All right, Catherine and Aubrey had some similar questions, but I want to play both of them because it gets to the heart of election integrity and fraud. So here's first Catherine.
Hi, Jenna. This is Catherine from the Hudson Valley of New York State. Thanks for today's story about the election results. I appreciate that a lot. I'm wondering if you could cover election fraud, because I feel like everyone's talking about it, but I don't know that it actually really happens that much. So I would love a little of your even-handed coverage of that issue. Thanks. Have a great day.
That's a really big question, Catherine. I'm going to get to it in just a second. Here's Aubrey, who has a question about election integrity.
So, question. I have spoken with several individuals this past week who are questioning the electoral process and have given up on voting because they don't think it will count or be counted fairly. And this seems like a pretty big deal, and I have a feeling that sentiment is likely held by quite a few people. If memory serves me correctly, it seems like that was one of the primary drivers behind the events of January 6th. So I'm curious, in your reporting, what evidence have you seen to establish the credibility of the voting process? I know you've mentioned many times about how states have governance over their own voting process, but how can we as Americans have some level or maybe reestablish our confidence behind turning out to vote? If election integrity was under such scrutiny, both to the Democratic Party when President Trump was elected and to the Trump administration when President Biden was elected, has there been any kind of reflection or optimization of this process at the state level in the last 4 years that should make a difference in how we think about the value of our vote? I don't feel like I've heard this issue discussed much by either party in this election cycle, and the fact that I'm hearing people concerned makes me wonder why it's not a bigger issue or something that's talked more about. Maybe it is a bigger issue and I've just missed it. I would love any insight you and the team have on this. Thanks.
These are really big, excellent questions about the process overall in the United States. And Aubrey's right. Knowing that your state is in charge of your election process is really critical to understanding where to go for questions. One of the reasons why election integrity is not discussed on a federal level in the way that we may want it to or think that it would be is because of the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution stipulates that states have the right to set up their own election process for federal elections. So there is an instant constitutional barrier against having, let's say, like a authoritative agency that's going to go and audit every single state. I mean, we do have the Federal Elections Commission that's looking into certain parts of the election process, specifically when it comes to funding, for example, and laws related to that. But there is that dividing line as the United States of America where we don't have that because that opens up another opportunity for questions. You know, if the federal government and a federal agency is somehow in charge here, then whoever is in office at the time could be perceived as being biased. And so this is part of the reasons why it's the state power to figure it out themselves. So let me take these questions a little bit kind of piece by piece. Let's talk a little bit about election fraud. That was Kate's question. It was interesting. I had a conversation with the Department of Homeland Security, and admittedly, I was skeptical of this conversation because they reached out to Smarter News. They're trying to do outreach to explain some of what they're doing to make sure that the process is safe and secure. But they have limited power in this because it's really up to the states. And so there's different sort of rumors, reports, questions about election fraud. For example, one of them has been in the past about non-citizens voting. And one of the things that you should know is that there are examples of non-citizens casting a ballot in our elections. That is true. It is also true that the recorded number is very low. I'm talking about maybe 24 was one of the numbers that was used in a certain state. We're talking about low numbers that wouldn't affect the outcome. The problem here is that your data is what it is. It's limited. So not to kind of take us down a windy road here, but let's think about numbers of encounters at the U.S. southern border, the number of people encountered coming across. That's what we know. We don't know the total number of the people that we did not see. And so that's one of the questions when it comes to the election process. Is there a big enough number of people participating here that could actually throw an election, but we're just not seeing it? We just don't have the data. So therefore, we don't know. We're sort of blind to it. There are guardrails set up in each and every state. They're just different depending on where you're voting. And in fact, I thought you would find this interesting. 36 states have laws requesting or requiring voters to show some form of documentation or identification at the polls. But another 14 states and the District of Columbia do not require any documentation to vote. So 14 states in DC do not require any documentation to vote at the polls. Poll workers are going to use other things like your signature identification, for example, but that is also true. So there are questions about whether or not election laws and guardrails have been updated enough to make sure that these elections are secure. What we can also report is as far as election fraud, we don't have an example in any state right now that has made it through the courts to suggest that there was prosecuted election fraud that would have changed the result of an election. The question is there something that we're not seeing out there? And that's true of all data, unfortunately. That's true of the JAWS report data that I showed you. It's true of immigration data that we're talking about related to the border. We do have limitations to some of our data. From what we're seeing, from what I've covered, there hasn't been fraud at a level where it has impacted the results. Is there something that we're not seeing and not considering? There's always that. And so it's really up to the states to make sure that they're explaining the process and explaining their guardrails enough to get the confidence of the voters, which is really what Aubrey's talking about. Well, what about just general confidence? That's really for the election officials to do outreach and say, hey, here's what we're doing. Here's something I learned, for example, in the Department of Homeland Security call. I would like to explore this a little bit further. We're a little bit short on time. But it was that there's a database that the Department of Homeland Security has that allows different states to access and compare their voter rolls against anyone that the Department of Homeland Security has interacted with to try to see, is that a way to determine that someone that perhaps is in the country, for example, pursuing an asylum claim, is actually showing up on a voter roll? How many states are taking advantage of that database to cross-compare or have the resources to? That's a big question. And so even if resources exist, have we been able to put them into effect to make sure that there's, if, even if there's questions about integrity, there's an answer of here's what we're doing about it. And Aubrey, I think that's where it goes back to the states themselves explaining, here's what we're doing. And that would be interesting for you to check on your particular state. Maybe it, are you a state where no one needs to show identification? And are we at a point in American society where more states consider that to be something that needs to be done? If we're carrying around a phone with us all the time, and most people are, does that mean that we should be required to carry ID with us when we're voting? What are the reasons not to do that? And so here's where, again, these questions about integrity are constantly brought up and refreshed, and states adjust. Let me give you an example that has been somewhat controversial in the state of Michigan. So the state of Michigan, obviously a very important swing state. And the governor in power right now is a very prominent Democrat. One of the new laws that was passed in that state is that there was going to allow more of an early processing of votes. So there, you know, one of the ways to kind of solve this gridlock issue of too many votes having to be processed day of, we're going to be able to process some of them early. Now, that could be viewed as a solution of, look at, the state's going to be proactive. But under a Democrat administration, that can be viewed as skeptical of, well, wait, is someone going to know the results sooner? If someone gets a sense of the results, can they start changing the results or encouraging other voters? I mean, there's questions that voters have that are legitimate. And one of the worst things that we can do in the media or in the government is to just sort of shrug them off and be like, yeah, listen, there's no record of election fraud, so it passed as precedent and there's nothing to see here, folks. No, there's questions that voters have, and we should deal with those questions as they come up. And I think that's one of the ways that I would tackle that question about election integrity is, well, what are your specific questions? If you have a question about voter ID laws in your state, what are they? How do we go through them? How does your state ensure that you can't present a fake ID? Is that possible? Do they double check? What are the different ways that they're double and triple sourcing voting that's taking place? Many states, that's what they do. They get the results and then they have this whole process of checking them before they're officially turned over and certified by the state. I think a lot of us don't realize that that's happening because the media is making a call for the election so early. We're not even recognizing that all of this is happening in the background. And when you don't realize that that's happening in the background, that couldn't make you feel a little bit better, it gets all messy. It gets really messy. So I don't know if I can completely answer all of that, you know, and reinstill, for example, the feeling of election integrity. I think it's just important to point out that there are guardrails set up in different states. Every state does it a little bit differently. And I think it's really important. It's one of the things I talked about with the Department of Homeland Security is to recognize where there's flaws, recognize that non-citizens have actually voted before, and then explain what are the different processes in place to make sure that doesn't happen. So people do feel confident about the process. So hopefully that's helpful. It's a big question. And I think it's a really tough one because if you can't trust the process, then as you point out, Aubrey, maybe you don't want to participate. And that's exactly what we don't want in a system of government like we have. So we'll see. We'll see how many of those questions come up as we get results. And that's what I would just want to kind of preface here where we could be in a new place where there's all of these prognostications that we're not going to get results. We could get results election night. We could totally get results election night. Enough results from different states for these decision desks to call a president. It could absolutely happen. So I don't want you to think if there's an early call that that is somehow not a valid result. And there can be recounts happening in different states. And in some states, you just have to ask for a recount. You don't have to say that there's fraud. You could just say, I want it recounted, and a recount will happen. So we're going to have to take that kind of in bite-sized pieces when it comes up. But I don't want you to also be surprised that we do have a result election night. So as we're going back to what some of these analysts and pollsters are saying, comparing 2024 to 2016 may be a more accurate comparison because 2020 may be seen as an outlier because of all the different dynamics at play. I hope that's helpful. Okay, there's a few other questions I want to get to. And Gina, this is one that you had. And I also saw a question on the board today that I thought was really important. I'm going to try to see if I can go back. Ah, Sarah, you had it as well. So Gina was asking, she said, hi team, I'm curious about the role of RFK Jr. in this election. I found it very interesting that he chose to stay on the ballot in the non-swing states. Do you think that will help send a message about possible third-party candidates in the future? Do you think it will have any bearing on this election? Thanks for your thoughts. And so Sarah also added, I wish the media would give equal attention to all parties and not just the two major parties. Sarah, I agree, because we do have candidates from the Libertarian Party and the Green Party that are going to be on the ballot in a variety of different states. And specifically in 2016, there were Democrats that were really mad at Jill Stein for staying on the ballot because they felt that she took votes specifically away from Hillary Clinton and therefore changed the election. And in certain states, she actually got enough of, I'm just pulling up Jill Stein right now for those of you who may be less familiar with her. She got, 1 to 2% of the vote. And when we're talking about margins of a few thousand voters in states like Georgia and Michigan, anyone getting any other votes is a major issue. So she's let me go ahead and pull this up for you. Jill Stein continues to run. And we also have a share of different libertarians that are running as well. So she has her whole platform out here and she's going to be on, she represents the Green Party. Let me go ahead and look up here, Libertarian candidate. Sorry for the typing, but I want to show you. The Libertarian Party is Chase Oliver, and we haven't talked about him at all. Let me see if I could pull him up. I think it's important you see him. So for those double haters that we talked about earlier, this could be a factor in the election. They could go in and say, you know what, I'm just going to vote for Jill Stein. You know what, I'm just going to go ahead and vote for Chase Oliver. I don't even know who he is, but I think I just want to do something different. And depending on how many votes these candidates can get, it could really impact the election. It's real. So one of the things that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. did is he asked the judge, he asked the courts actually to remove him from certain swing state ballots because he didn't want any confusion. And especially because of those voters that responded to Smarter News that said that they like the team dynamic of former President Trump, fielding this team of different people. He's concerned, RFK Jr. was concerned, that it could be confusing for voters and that he could get the vote over former President Trump. And someone could think that they're voting for that ticket when they're really not, and taking votes away from former President Trump. The Supreme Court ruled that they basically denied his bid to remove him from the ballot. So it's really up to every different state law and what the states are determining about whether or not he can pull his name from the ballot or not. I think that could also be a factor, and we won't know until we actually get the results. Did voters get a little confused, or did they really want to vote for him? If they wanted him in a certain role in the government, did they understand that they had to vote for former President Trump? And we're just not going to know. It is important to note in 2016, those third party candidates were thought to affect the results because of how close some of the margins were in a state like Michigan. So I do think it's important to point out that they're on the ballot and they're a factor. And yeah, they don't get a lot of time and attention by the media. I'm just as guilty as it is anybody else.
in the effort to try to keep everybody up to date on what's going on with the two major parties, we miss them. And maybe they would get even more votes if they had more coverage. I think it's a really important point. Okay, final question here. And this is from Steph. And this is a good one. And it brings in some policy issues here. So Stephanie had a question about what determines if a law, executive order, regulation has to be approved by Congress or can just be enacted by the president without congressional approval. I heard former President Trump's tariff proposal does not have to go through Congress. Is this true? So this is interesting. You have a lot of different, a lot of people promising different things when it comes to the president and presidential power. And we have to point out that although the president is the top of the ticket and is gets the big spotlight, gets the big White House, you know, gets all that, those different perks of a president, they really do have limited power. The one area where they don't have extraordinarily limited power, where they'd have to work through Congress for legislation, is actually through tariffs. And that is because Congress has over the years empowered the president, empowered the executive office to have more leeway for how they want to use tariffs. Part of this has to do with some national security concerns. You know, if the president is the one that can declare war and is the commander in chief of the U.S. military, then tariffs is a tool for foreign policy discussions and debate and issues. And so this is part of the reason why the president was able to get a little bit more power than, let's say, having to pass legislation for certain tariffs to be in place. Congress can also attempt that, and the president could sign it into law, but the president does have more power in this area, any president, not just former President Trump, to start tinkering. This is why, too, you know, have you heard this when former President Trump's on the campaign trail and he's like, yeah, well, President Biden kept my tariffs in place. That's true in the way that President Biden or whoever was in the executive office at the time can make those decisions and doesn't have to go back through Congress to do it all over again if they want to keep certain laws or policies in place. There are certain executive actions that the president can take. And when it comes to tariff, there's more leeway than others. Now, on other issues, for example, abortion is a big topic. And there has been a lot of conversation on all sides about what does the future of abortion law look like in America, or what, you know, how permissive or prohibitive future law can be for this in this particular area. And I think it's important to point out here, this is why the president matters, in that legislation around that topic can be passed by Congress and upheld or rejected by the Supreme Court. So the presidential power to choose and appoint a Supreme Court justice is where the president can really have an effect on that particular issue. But as far as having some sort of wand that can say, this is a constitutional right, this is not a constitutional right, this is what's going to happen in different states, that's not within the president's power to do so. So I think it's important to know that, because there's a lot of accusations being thrown on all sides about that. And on that particular issue, part of the reason why this has been such a big story is because of legal challenges to existing law that wound up in the Supreme Court, not about new legislation that different presidents have tried to push through Congress or Congress has tried to gain momentum. That's how we kind of wound up in this debate about abortion law in America. It's because of challenges to existing law that made them their way through the courts to the Supreme Court. And that's where you see the power of the president reflected by who they appoint to the Supreme Court. I hope that makes sense. How's everyone feeling? Did that answer any burning questions? I hope so. Let me see if there's anything else that we could pull up today as we're sort of thinking about, you know, the different paths to victory. We have a couple different maps I was kind of looking through. And I like our little faces that we tried to put. We try to put faces on the different swing states because it's easier visually. You know, one of the stories I did a couple weeks ago is this whole idea of red being assigned to Republicans and blue being assigned to Democrats actually was switched a few decades ago. So blue was for Republicans and red was for Democrats. Sometimes we were using yellow. I mean, it's really, again, these are editorial choices that really matter. But sometimes looking at the map, it's tough to tell, you know, whose state belongs to where and how does it all work and what is the different math that's being added up. So it's really a race to do math on election night. And that's what these different decision decks are doing. So that's what we're going to see. And even showing you some of these states right now, you know, we'll have Vice President Harris potentially winning Nevada. Maybe there's thinking former President Trump may inroads there. You know, will Vice President Harris actually win in North Carolina? Former President Trump has won there before. So it's really tough. It's really, really tough to know. Amy has a question. Then how did President Biden erase student loan debt? Was that approved by a legislative branch? So, Amy, that's a very interesting policy decision, executive action taken by the White House, and it was instantly challenged legislatively. It was challenged in the courts, but it's also being challenged by members of Congress saying that the president has overstepped, because when it comes to the matters of our money, our representatives are supposed to make those decisions, not the president unilaterally. And the erasing of debt, let me see if I could do these mental acrobatics, would be like erasing money that's owed to the American people. And therefore, there was a question about whether any executive could do that, because it's really money owed to the people, not something that's owed to the White House or owed to the government. So that's why there was a challenge to that. He's tried to do a series of different things. And sometimes there was a challenge in the court that caused a reversal, that there were new plans that were put forward. And sometimes the legal challenges take time. Another executive action that's facing legal challenge is what President Biden did at the southern border, which is saying that if you come across the border without legal status and you want to try to pursue asylum, you can't. You're not going to be able to. You're going to be punished. Technically, U.S. law allows you to appeal for asylum when you have 2 feet on U.S. soil. That's the law. So for the president to say, if you come across illegally and you have 2 feet here, you can't do it, is a little bit of a gray area. And there are groups that would typically be more aligned with Democrat policies that were challenging that. So whether or not that stands is a big question. So yes, Lola, I look forward to a live chat tomorrow and do a couple live chats maybe throughout the day. I'll send out a couple notes to that to your inbox so that you won't miss it. If you have additional questions, I'd love to answer them. I know it's a little bit of a confusing process. Aubrey's asking, what's the status of the new Smarter News hats? They should be delivered this week or early next week, Aubrey. So that's exciting. Thank you to all of you who shopped our gear. If you'd like to check it out, you just go to smarternews.com and we have some new stuff that's really exciting and I love it. Thanks for representing us. I'm just doing a quick perusal of all your different questions, seeing if there's anything new that's coming up. I think we did a lot of good work here today, guys. I feel like we are prepped and ready. I'm just making sure I didn't miss anything. I have notes all over the place. How's everyone feeling? Any final words before we get into election day? How's everyone feeling about this? Let's see if Real Clear Politics moved at all from the tie. So in the Real Clear Politics average, again, I'd be very hesitant about this. The national average is still a tie. The top battleground states are bending slightly to former President Trump, but not within the margin of error. That's actually a good thing to talk about. Margin of error can be 2 to 3 points. So you can have a poll that has, let's say, former President Trump up by 3 points, and then he ends up losing by 3 points, and that would be within the margin of error, you know, or he ends up losing, and that's within a margin of error because it could go up 3 points above that or below that. You see what I'm saying? So you have to be really careful with some of these polling too and the sort of margin of error. Okay. Patty says they missed a question about absentee ballots for the military, a military question about that. And it is true that overseas ballots do come back to the states and they will be counted. I want to say they're the last that are counted. It depends on your state again. And sometimes, depending on the number, I don't want to go too far off too far, like ad-libbing on this, because it really depends on your state about when those are actually processed, where military ballots are processed, and if you're also voting from abroad. So the astronauts also cast their ballots. So there's a process for everybody. It's just how exactly it works within that state. So, all right, guys, thank you so much for your time, for your thoughts. And Emily's asking for beanies, Smarter News beanies. I think that's on the horizon. Emily, I don't want to get too excited about it. I think it's on the horizon.
Lindsay's telling us that in Missouri, military ballots are accepted through Friday. So that's good to know. So you see, it really depends on your state. So if there's any issues with military ballots, definitely got to look at your state website. And let's go into the day feeling good. Here's my final quick thought. I'm going to share some of this, I believe, on social. I think it's really important to kind of get into the news stream, but I just want to share this with you. I think it's an important thing to think about before we get to all the commentary about what could happen and the results. You have been told for years, you know, how divided America is. And there's a reason for that. It's because our elections are really tight. It's because you have almost an equal number of Republicans and Democrats in the House of Representatives. Same with the Senate. And when things are so close, equally weighted and equally strong, then we say, well, America's never been more divided. But I want you to really think about that language there, because the reality is I could describe it as also being balanced. One of the reasons why our elections are so close is because we're really balanced. Because when we look across even the popular vote, even the Electoral College vote, we're very balanced. It's tough to pass legislation through Congress, through the House of Representatives, when you have almost two equally strong sides. So imagine for the last several years, if someone was telling you how balanced you are instead of how divided you are. And think about how that word has impacted the storytelling of the American political process. And every time you hear someone say, well, we've never been more divided than before, then you should say, well, we've never been more balanced. And opposition really is an opportunity for refinement. If you have to confront someone that's very strong on the other side, it's an opportunity for you to really question whether or not you really believe what you say. And that can be very uncomfortable, because it's a lot easier just to be in an echo chamber and feel kind of good about what's being said back to you. But that's not the reality of the American political process right now. The reality is that you're going to confront someone that just totally disagrees with you, and they're going to be just as strong with just as many people. And it's uncomfortable because we're being challenged, but the opportunity for refinement is there. Opposition is the opportunity for refinement. And I firmly believe we're going through this period in America because we're trying to get to that, whatever that next side is, the next part of the story. There are very few places in the world where that's allowed, where opposition is even allowed. And instead of talking about how divided we all are all the time, I think we should talk about how balanced we are and why that's difficult. It doesn't mean that we're equal. It just means that we're balanced. We have a balance of opinion. And so it takes very little to tip those scales in the election process. And it takes a lot to move legislation through Congress because of that. But that's a reflection of the people. So you should walk around instead of feeling divided. Oh, America's never been more divided than ever before. How about we just say, yeah, we've never been more balanced. It feels totally different. And it's a reminder of how powerful the media is and how powerful storytelling is. Imagine if we told you for the last several years how balanced you are, how you might walk around in this space a little differently. So watch for the words that are being used to describe both candidates. Really watch for it. Ward off against these sort of editorial commentary that's now just a part of our lexicon, like no one even thinks about it. And start asking some questions about it. Does that really reflect how I feel in this space? And does that really reflect the country right now, or my reality? And don't let someone else tell you what your story is. Choose your story. That's what voting's about, choosing our story. So I hope you guys have a great start to your week, and I'm looking forward to watching the election results along with you for however long it takes. And we'll see. There's no way of predicting. We're just going to have to let the story develop at its own pace. It's one of the hardest things you can do in life. It's something very difficult to do in news, but it's important that we do it together. So thank you for your belief in quick, concise, nonpartisan news, except when we're long-winded in a podcast like this. But we really appreciate you. And think about that. I really need someone to tell me I'm balanced these days because I'm a mom of three and I'd feel totally unbalanced. I'm going to take that with a little wind on my back. And I look forward to your questions, your thoughts, your comments as we go forward together. So thanks for being part of our developing story. We love being a part of yours. And we'll see you tomorrow on Election Day. Times to come, invites to come. And thank you for your support of Smarter News. Have a great day, guys. I'll talk to you soon. Bye. Thank you for believing in quick, concise, nonpartisan Smarter News. Every time you join us or share or save our content, you help us build a solution in news. And we are so grateful. We have a few other ways you can support our mission, from joining our insider community Scoop, to shopping our gear at our Smarter Shop, to just telling a friend. The best way to do any of this is to visit smarternews.com or follow us at Smarter News on social media. Don't worry, we put all of this in the captions so it's easy for you. Plus, we added our email just in case you want to drop us a note. We always love hearing from you. Thank you for helping us deliver news smarter.